Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. How are you doing? I give a shit. You know what? It's a little hot out here today. Amazing. We got summer going on. There we go. Anyway, I'm so glad you tuned in. Thanks for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. You know me. I'm a self-proclaimed psychotherapist with a very big mouth. Thanks for listening. I'm here every Thursday, 2 to 3. And you know what? You are so lucky because you're listening to the greatest radio station in the Western Hemisphere. I've checked all of them, and this is literally Radio Free Brooklyn is the best. So I want to encourage you to go to radiofreebrooklyn.org. Check us out. Look at all. We have amazing programming of like things that you couldn't even imagine. We have programming for that. So whatever your thing is, besides, of course, it's this, but anything, any kind of music, whatever you want. Don't forget to go to the donation page and give us some money, buy a t-shirt, you know, come on. All right. Well, I have this really amazing guest today. Actually, I don't usually like to have friends on because this is, it's usually like I already know them and I'm afraid of like asking them really personal shit because I already know a lot of the answers. But I have a very close friend on today and we're going to talk about a topic that we haven't discussed. Just because we're usually busy doing other things when we're hanging out. But anyway, Holly Dorito. And you're going to meet her in a second. But first, I have something else that is super, super, super important. I am doing a live show a week from today, okay? And I would love if you would come see it because it's going to be incredible. It's going to be incredible. Here's the deal. So I have two comedians and one visual artist, right? And what I do is I do a speed therapy session on them after they do their set. And in the case of the visual artist, she's going to do a presentation of her work. And that way you can find out what their real story is and what's really going on and what they were thinking when they made the work and all that. And you can like, you know, we can get the dirt on them. So I'm sort of like turning this like fun show into like a gossip festival. I mean, you could say that, or maybe it'll just be some insights. Let's hope. And they have really cheap drinks. So it's called Stand Up, Lie Down, and it's at the City Reliquary, which is 370 Metropolitan Avenue in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. It's near the L. Lorimer stop. City Reliquary is a great, small, civic New York City Museum, and they have amazing exhibitions there and live shows. So, and you know what else? Guess who the headliner is? You're not going to believe it. Christian Finnegan. He was on the show about a month ago and he agreed to do it. So we're going to have him, Shakir Stanley, and Tara Lewis, who just completed a visual art portraits of Brooke Shields and Brooke Shields' grown daughters. It's really like a hot, it's amazing. So go to the City Reliquary, Tickets with Friends, go to my ticketswithfriends.co is, you know, look it up on there, Stand Up, Lie Down, or you can go to any of my social media accounts and find tickets there. Okay, there, we did that. So, okay, now Holly, we're getting to Holly. Okay, so Holly Dorito is a very, very original, special, delightful, and I don't even know how to describe her. A thoughtful, creative. I keep thinking big personality, but she's not really because she is she's not loud, but her presence is always felt, and she has a lot of fans because mostly she's known for the founder and director of Waggy Tail Rescue, which I think of her as a Schindler of dogs. She's been saving dogs for how long, Holly?
Officially, my rescue has been around since 2004, but thanks to an awesome mom, basically since the time I was born.
Okay, yeah. So Holly grew up in small town Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania, and she had animals around all the time. And, you know, her mom, I guess, you know, you had. But I know Holly very, very well. I've known her since like 2003. We went and rescued. I helped her. I assisted her rescuing dogs from a shelter in Tijuana, Mexico last year during the pandemic, which was amazing. Particularly to me, it's just a story of Holly's life, just routine for her. So we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff today. So Holly, hi. Did I cover everything? Is there anything that we missed?
Absolutely, you're perfect.
Okay,
as always.
Oh, shut up, shut up, Holly. So anyway, Holly has worked as a dominatrix, and we're going to talk to Holly because she learned how to train horses. Then she learned how to train humans, and now she's back to mostly training dogs. But Holly and I have never really had a deep discussion with details about her times that she has been a dominatrix, and I don't really know much about that, so I think it'll be really interesting. But why don't we start off, Holly, by telling us about like how your upbringing got you into training horses and stuff like that.
Well, I grew up like in Pennsylvania, and I was obsessed with horses as a child, and I started riding at the age of 7.
Wow.
And my family took in an abandoned Appaloosa horse. We had a little farm, and he was kicked off a thoroughbred farm where he was dumped after a divorce, and they said he was the ugliest horse they had ever seen. So we were like, yeah, that's our horse. And he was the ugly duckling outcast, and I trained him to be second state champion hunter jumper 2 years in a row.
Fuck. I didn't even know that.
That's, yeah.
So did you feel like you had, at age 7, you had like a way of understanding him, an intuition?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was around 10 or 11 when we got him. And then my first job was really when I was 14, 15, 16, I used to go to the stable, and I was able to handle all of the difficult horses during veterinary and farrier visits. I just had that sort of intuitive connection. And I think it was from growing up, you know, rehabilitating wildlife as a kid is I learned to read animals at a really young age and how to interact with them.
So you were living on, your family was living on a farm, right? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
And so what kind of animals, like, give us an idea of like what kind of creatures were around, what your interaction with them was?
Well, we had a couple of different horses, and I used to work with training and rehabilitating abused horses. And we lived near a farm, and I used to go pet the little calves in the boxes when I was a little kid. And then one day I found out the real story that they were veal calves, and I've been vegetarian, vegan ever since the age of 14.
Ugh, that's the worst.
Yeah.
Calves.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's the worst to find out that we eat those things. Like a big old cow isn't quite as, maybe not quite as bad. I don't know.
I know. They used to lick my hands, and I would feed them corn, and they were like baby deer, which I loved deer. And like they just, and I would like look into their eyes, and then I found out what was happening to them. And then that was like, I have never eaten beef since then.
Holly looks like she's about to cry right now. I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding you, people.
Oh, people,
so let's change
stop.
The subject. But you had—I know you talked about. We've talked about this before, didn't you? Have like little animals that were out in the wild that would your mom would bring in.
We did, and we lived next to a wildlife sanctuary, so we would rehabilitate wildlife, and you know we would bottle feed, you know, baby bunnies whose moms had been hit by a car, and help birds with broken wings. And I think from a young age, I learned that sometimes we did lose some, but to move on. And I think that's what's really given me the strength to do rescue for all of these years and not just have a complete meltdown like I've come close to a few times.
So you're able, you really are connected to the animal world in that way, in a way of understanding it and kind of a intuitive level that people who are brought up like me in urban environment, more urban environments can, you just can't, you know, it's like learning a language when you're young.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
So was your mother, were your parents really animal people too then?
Yeah, they were. They always have been. More human people than my, both of them are Red Cross volunteers. My mom was on the National Disaster Red Cross team. She actually came here for 9/11, which was crazy.
Wow, really?
So all of this type of work has just been sort of something that's been a part of my life and a part of my soul. But you know, it's like, I also need a little variety.
Right. And you have a ridiculously fun spirit. Like, you're somebody who is always like, you know, like, you've turned me on to so many like interesting, fascinating people. I mean, I met Reverend Jen through you, and so many amazing, fascinating people and activities. And like, didn't you just go to like some, what was it, a Dolly, just this week, Dolly, like 2 days
ago. Oh, the Dolly Parton drag.
How was that?
Oh my God, it was so much fun. What can be more fun than Dolly Parton in drag? So great.
Yeah, so you're it's really funny because you're such a, like, you know, you're so connected to nature and animals, but like, you're so urban too, you know?
It's yeah.
Really, like, you're so into the, like, all the kinds of stimulation, you know, a million... Holly knows a lot of famous people, a lot of famous comedians, and, you know, you kind of can rock both extremes, nature and urban area, right? That makes sense.
It's just because I'm weird and I just go out there and I'm like, okay, this is what it is. Well, I'm shameless, you know, I don't care about, like, I'm shameless. I've asked so many celebrities to like do things for my dog rescues because I'm shameless for asking for animals. And I think most people are grateful to do it too. You know, it's not like it's a bad thing.
You're kind of making it easy for them, giving them opportunities. Like, you've had, Janine Garofalo's on your show, on your, benefits a lot. And,
right. David Cross volunteered for my rescue and, my flight program, and flew my own girl dog's father from Los Angeles to New York in a program to get dogs one by one on carry-on flights. And I'm still in touch with him, and he actually, top secret, might be popping in on a show I'm doing at the Slipper Room in August.
Oh, all right.
Which I just heard back from him this morning.
What day is that?
It's August 27th, and it's going to be Tammy Faye Starlight doing her Blondie cover. And Janine Garofalo and Rob Paravonian. And it's actually a repeat of a benefit we did in 2018, I believe it was, that was sold out. And people still talk about how fun it was. And so I was like, you know what? All these people are still around. Let's just do it again. So yeah, we're doing it.
I mean, honestly, Holly's benefits, or I should say Waggytail benefits, are the best. Holly has a million rescue volunteers. I've volunteered at them, and they're usually amazing events. And I want you guys to know that you can go to Waggytail Rescue. That's right, waggytailrescue.org, and look at, you know, and get all the info. Okay. And you can also sign up to volunteer, donate, and also foster. I actually I never had a dog until, well, I got a dog through Holly, through Waggytail, in 2011. It was the first dog I ever had. But before that, because of my work schedule, I would do some rescuing. So that's how... Partly, that's one of the ways that I got to know Holly, through rescuing dogs. And it's so great. I used to call myself a dog slut because you get a different dog, you fall in love with it, but then you give it to a good home, get a new one, you know. So anyway, so how did you come to New York, and how did you get into the world of being a dominatrix?
Well, I started coming up for the music scene, just riding up. This guy who lived a mile from my grandmother in the sticks was a roadie for a band. And one day I took a trip up with him to New York, and I just sort of fell in love with the music scene and started coming up here all the time. I got my dream job internship at Rolling Stone magazine. I was going for journalism, and I was working, I was interning, I was taking, credits, and I was working a horrible waitressing job. And I went on vacation with my best friend from high school, Leslie, who the two of us were just always the ones into trouble. And then we had the third one, Marnie, who was the voice of reason, who usually talked us down. But Marnie wasn't along with us this time.
She was a stop.
She was, yeah. She was at home.
Safety. She was
scared to go on this trip. So we got into there are many, many little epic stories off of this trip that have led to kind of some incredible things down the line. But one of them was, we were on the plane and she said, "Hey, Fred is dating this girl." Fred was a guy who was, he was an ex-boyfriend of mine. And he's like, "Fred is dating this guy who, or this woman who spanks men, and she gets paid a lot of money for it." And I was like, "No way, really?" I was like, "Is there really such a thing?" I had no idea. I was like, I was 20 years old. I was completely naive, fresh to New York from Pennsylvania. And so she was like, "Yeah." And so I got back to New York and I looked, and she's like, "I dare you to go into one of those places." And of course, never say, well, once somebody plants the seed in. So I still remember the exact words. It was in the back of the New York Press, and it said, "Adult fantasy role play. No sex, no nudity, $$$." And I was like, why not? So I had a bold day, and I maybe did a little edible, called the place up, and I went in, and I was really just going in to have a look. And they were like, "Oh, you're total all-American blonde. You can really make money here."
Wow.
And I was like, I've gone this far, I've got to try it. So I did, and my first session was, and I still remember, with Mistress Ursula, who lives in my neighborhood and I'm still friends with, and we run into each other at the grocery store all the time. But I was like her little intern. And that was my first session. And I was Mistress Victoria, and I ended up, it became like a great deal for me because I would work like 8-hour shifts, and maybe I would see like, three clients for an hour. And in between that time, I could study and do my schoolwork, whereas waitressing, you're just on your feet all the time. You don't have an opportunity to do jack shit.
Right.
So I graduated second in my class and with no college debt.
Wow, that's amazing. Where did you go to school?
Queens College.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Good. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's such a great. I don't even want to say it's a trade off. It's a great way to. It's great. It's just great way to manage that way, manage that phase of your life. What a great thing to pay for college.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because there are a lot of temptations, a lot of the girls who worked in the house I worked at got sucked into, like, the guy who ran it, dealt coke. So he would get them on coke. So basically they would earn money and then buy coke from him. I just played dumb, kind of stayed away from everybody, did my own thing. I had one friend there and we would just goof off together and kind of did my own thing. But and then from there, I went on my own. And I mean, it's a lot of work. People don't realize the amount of work that actually does go into it. I can say genuinely, I had no idea. And even like now looking back on it, it's still like, it's hard for me to comprehend because there's so much time you have to spend marketing and talking to people and doing photo shoots and making appointments for people to bail, and they're just jerking off on bailing. And it's very frustrating because it's like you'll have you'll like nurture 10 clients and one of them will show, but
right.
it's still you know, it was the 90s. People had money to spend. BDSM was a lot more taboo then. And so it was probably the prime time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have had a better time to do it.
So it was less, it's probably a lot more, well, now every, you know, the porn business has totally exploded everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, if you call it, do you consider that part of the porn business? I mean, you were dressed, or were you dressed?
I mean, I guess there's some crossovers. I mean, I used to have the guy who used to like to fuck a blow up doll in front of me.
That sounds very, that just sounds entertaining.
My thing was, because I kind of didn't, I wasn't really, I mean, I listened to goth music. I was totally like into like, the goth, like weirdo, like, but so I kind of actually had some of the outfits, but I'm a nurturing, kind human, healing person by nature. So for me, it was really like an acting job, like challenging myself to do something, to step out of the box and do something that I really wouldn't do. And also going to school for journalism, I'm like, this is going to give me some writing material.
Yeah. So what was it like? Like, how did you feel about the men that you interacted with? Like, do I sound really naive that I've never like been, I've never, yeah. You know, I've got a big mouth. I'm too complicated. Men don't want to bother with me. It's too much. I talk too much, but about bullshit. But so what did it, like, how did you feel about the men? Did it change how you looked at men? Did it change, like, were they all different? What were the dudes like? What was it like dealing with dudes on that level, in that way?
You know, it was really different. Some of them I hated them and they sucked. Some of them I felt like, some of them were just like, were gross, and gropey, and like just had utter disrespect for women. And this, but some of the, most of them, I guess I had more of a curiosity about, because I was really interested in like the weird fetishes, that kind of like a lot of the mainstream dungs, because that was their lifestyle. They really just wanted to do the BDSM pain infliction back and forth, and like really, like some of them actually, like, you know, they really enjoyed inflicting pain, or they really enjoyed fucking guys up the ass with dildos. My thing was, I just wanted to see the weirdest things that turn people on and try to figure out like why. And I actually had a lot of sympathy for them, because, you know, a lot of them had wives and stuff, and I felt really bad because like they were too embarrassed to tell their significant others or like people they knew in their personal lives that they had this fetish. So they had to pay somebody, which I'm glad they had somebody to pay to do it. You know what I mean? So for me, I was like, I felt like a therapist for a lot of them. You know?
I can see that, because it's a transactional relationship, which is a lot more honest than pretending that somebody's manipulating somebody.
Exactly. Exactly. It was just like, you know, straight up honest, like, this guy, this is what I want. And I'm actually still kind of friends with some of my clients, or I became friends with them. But
it's almost like being, I mean, there's a certain, like, it's really funny. There's a nursing aspect to it, right? Because did you say your mother was a nurse? Why do I think that? Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's a nursing aspect, because you're dealing with the body and healing. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you have a specific type of clientele? They said, oh, that's one for Holly, or?
Well, I mean, you know, it was like kind of the typical, like, who people who came in were like the people in power who wanted to be like, you know. But when guys had like weird requests, you know, a lot of, they'd be like, that's one for Holly.
What?
That's one for Holly. Or, you know, I mean, they would get to choose, but I guess I sort of had like a little bit of like a reputation for being sort of, instead of just like being really, really strict and mean, like my best friend there, she was like, she really liked to, like, she liked to beat the shit out of guys and bruise them and make them bleed.
Oh.
And she enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Where my was more like the playful. You know, the guy in the dungeon described me once as the little girl in the sound box who looked cute and smiled at you and then kicked sand in your face when you got too close.
love that. I love that. So were you good at holding on to your boundaries? Did you know at that young age what your boundaries were? That's what scares me, or that's what makes me protective of young women. Did you know your boundaries?
I did. And if there's something I didn't want to do or I wasn't comfortable with, usually I would try it at least once. I mean, I wouldn't nice. I never had sex with anybody, like, and my clients, like, you know, as long as it's something that wouldn't hurt me. But like, you know, like double fisting, I didn't want to do it, but I knew I wasn't going to like it. Like two fists up a guy, but I tried it once and I was like, no fucking way I'm ever doing that again. But but I would try it once, and then I would say, okay, I'm not doing that again. So most of the time, I would try something unless it was like, but I would draw my boundaries and I would say, you know what? That's not something I'm going to do. I never did scat. I couldn't shit on a guy. I couldn't puke on a guy. Peeing on a guy, I was fine with. But you know, if there's something that I wasn't into, it's just, I would say no. So.
Ooh. So how did you feel? Did the men, like, did they seem sad or did they seem just like, what did you, how did it change the way that you looked at men or?
Not really. There's some way it has to affect your psyche, but as much as possible, I separated it. It did make it really hard, dating.
And yeah.
I really couldn't date. The only thing I could date was, like, you know, I have to say it, drummers, you know.
Drummers?
band guys who with terrible lives who were unreliable. But to have like a relationship, it just really, it was almost like I had to choose between a career and a relationship, because I tried doing normal dating and I guess my mind is more open than most people, than I had anticipated people's being. And so I just focused on doing
it freaked
that.
The guys out.
And I just did my own thing. And, you know, maybe that's why I started doing dog rescue.
Mm-hmm. So men couldn't deal with that at all.
No.
Did you try to hide it or were you just completely transparent?
I was always transparent. You know, like I wouldn't say it on like on the first date, but it's like, you know, it's like.
You didn't announce it, but you didn't hide
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Because, right. I mean, as far as, and like a lot of the problem was the guys would be not believing that I wasn't having sex with them, which I was never naked. They weren't allowed to touch me. I wasn't having sex.
Yeah.
It was just, you know,
a service.
Unless it was like kissing my feet or something, you know?
Yeah, right.
I didn't jerk them off, you know?
Yeah.
It was a fantasy role play. And then, you know, I reserved my real sexy time for
who you wanted to have
yeah,
sex with.
Exactly. Exactly. I know. Uh-huh. It's kind of like, it was an acting job. I would separate myself and go into right. character. But I can understand how it's hard for a lot of guys to deal with. And then I realized also, because I have a friend who no longer is with us, but he used to work at a club, Don Hills. And every time, and I used to ride down after working on the dungeon, I'd sometimes still be in my Dom gear and, you know, show up at midnight and go to Beaver, the dance party. And he would always go behind the van and pull his pants down and he would say, is this the biggest dick you've seen today? And I would always say, oh my gosh, it's so much bigger than any penis I've seen today. And he'd be like, thank you, I feel so much better. And then he would let me in free.
I love that. I love that. That's hilarious.
But I realized like a lot of guys probably had like some sort of thing like, I've seen a bigger or more appealing looking dick than mine.
Oh, you're probably right.
But it doesn't mean I
hadn't even thought about that.
That doesn't mean I want to fuck or suck it, you know?
You know, it's so weird. I think this is true. Do you? I think that men are really... Women, I don't think women think about penis size that unless it's very extreme one way or the other. I don't think it's preferable when it's extreme one way or the other either. Do you think women think about... Do you think men think about that a lot more?
I think they do. And I think, like, for women, it's like... We all have an appropriate, we all have something that seems to work for us. Like, too big is too big, too little is too little, too this is, you know what I mean? It's
it's
and usually it's not, it is, it's like what's behind it. It's like really like, I'm more attracted to somebody who's like, somebody can have like the nicest looking penis in the world, and if he's just like an asshole or an idiot, I'm like, I'm not, get away from me. You know?
Yeah. I don't want don't you think that's kind of like the last, or like in the hierarchy of things that you want out of a guy, like that's pretty low preference, as long as it's just average or normal?
Yeah, because you want it to be, it's supposed to be fun. You know what I mean? It's supposed to be fun, not just like a work to make this tool do something for me. Otherwise, I would just get a dildo.
Yeah.
You know, like why I'd get a dildo and a vibrator and wouldn't have to deal with an asshole if all I wanted was just like, you can buy a penis of any size, shape, whatever on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you feel like that you understand men in a certain way that better or in a new, different way than you might have otherwise? Or
yeah,
would you learn about the dudes? What can you tell us? Tell us. What are we missing? Well, I mean, I imagine you really understand the range of nuance in what men want sexually and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So what do you think? What do you think?
I mean, you definitely learned a lot. You learned because a lot of it, you have to study body language and reaction to what you're doing. Like if you have a writing crop and I'm doing something, you study their reactions. And so you have to have an intuition, even like, just like you do with animals, you have an intuition, you read their body language, you read their eyes, you see, you know, for humans, it's usually they have like, you know, there's a safe word and it's like, usually like green means go harder, yellow means, hey, slow down, I'm about at my max, and red means, hey, threshold, stop. Mm-hmm. And so you can use those communication skills, especially as you're getting to know somebody, to sort of just, you know, because mm-hmm. everybody's got a different tolerance. Everybody's got a different feel for what they like, mm-hmm. you know.
But, you know, there is something kind of like, I don't know if sad is a word, but just how our civilization has just gotten in the way of people being transparent about these kinds of things. What if, you know, what they really want to do, what they want from somebody else, what they want to share. Do you think that do you think a lot of it is imprinting? Like, do you think it's like they get imprinted, or where do you think like all these kinks come from? Do you have any thoughts on that? Or
I think it's a whole bunch of different things. I think some of it is just, you know, like everybody's born with different, like, quirks mm-hmm. of some sort, whether it be, you know, I don't know, just weird likes and dislikes that are not really explainable.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it's maybe they're born with a tendency and then they're tuned. Like I've had guys who have told me that they remember getting their first erection or the first time they came was when they were like being spanked over their babysitter's lap, or, you know, when spanking was the thing. Or when they were crawling around under the kitchen table mm-hmm. and, you know, around their aunt's feet at Thanksgiving, you know, just being a little kid worm or whatever, mm-hmm. or something that they saw on TV that just.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes think that men are more biologically controlled by their sex drive or sex proclivities. Do you think that's true?
I think so.
Yeah.
There have actually also been some neurological studies. There's a study on the phantom limb syndrome that actually found that there's some sort of a nerve between the feet and the sexual organ, the sexual stimulus of the brain that gets crossed. And that's a reason for foot fetish. And it's just like a genetic like bleep.
Wow.
And so that triggers some of the foot fetish stuff.
Wow. Is foot fetishes really common?
They're very, very common. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I've seen, I remember as a young person thinking about experimenting, getting paid for foot stuff because there was so much of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, wow. So you must, I mean, that's like a fascinating way to really understand the other, you know, to understand the male sexuality.
Yeah.
And how it motivates them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did anyone ever fall in love with you? Did you ever wind up dating any of these people, or?
I never ended up dating anybody. I really kept it separate. I became friends with some. I did have a few stalkers.
Mm.
There was only one that was like really bad, and fortunately, he found out where I lived, and he parked himself in front of my apartment for 2 weeks in my car, and his car like except for waiting. And I wasn't even in town; I was in California, and I found out he was there. And then I told one of my friends who was a bodyguard to get him, you know, tell him to get lost.
Ah, so you had protection.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't really sound, were you ever threatened? It doesn't sound particularly threatening.
No, I was never threatened. You know, it's like, you know, there were always people that I kind of got to know. Usually I got to know them outside and
mm-hmm.
got a good feel for them. Usually I would see like, you know, at least a copy of like their real ID, and I have their phone numbers and
But
I've also respected discretion. Like I've never given the name. I've seen some celebrities, and to this day, I won't tell anybody who, you know, it's just for, that's my personal thing is like, I really believe in.
I think sex work, should be I think it's a natural part of society, should be a natural part of society, because there are things that all of us want, women want, men, everybody, doesn't matter what gender you identify with or who you are. We all want to have sexual things, and we want to have control. We want to be able to get what we want when we want it in a sort of, it can be in just like a transactional way, which, I think transactional sex is actually kind of healthy and very different from sex with a partner or a lover. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And society has no clue about that, right?
Right. It's like, you know, there's the emotional aspect, and then there's some people, it's just like people need to, I don't know, they want to go for a swim, or they want to, you know, do something else.
Or they want to have sex right now, or like a lot of times when I was single, and I was single a lot, like almost all through my 30s, on and off, not the whole 10 years, but, and there were so many times, and in my day you couldn't do this, I would have just rather had somebody come over, pay them, and have them leave.
Yeah.
Like I had a boyfriend who said
women want that too sometimes.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
And it's normal, because I wound up having to, like, I'd get so, like, I haven't had sex in so long that I'd wind up like getting bleary eyed and dating somebody just because I hadn't had sex, and then thinking I wanted to date them.
Yeah.
And I think men, that happens a lot with men too. They don't talk about it as much. But I think that I'm hoping that, I mean, sex work is becoming a lot more integrated into society, and I think it should be like a very legitimate business, respectable business. Some people are actually like I think that you were performing a service, like you understood these people and you had your own boundaries, and I think that you were, like you said, you probably did some healing, I'm thinking, right?
Yeah.
Did you feel like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You guys got to get on the stick about like sex work and sex workers. It's really fine. It's really fine. We would all be better if we could access that in a respectable way. And there is something very respectable about it.
Right.
There you go. That's my lecture. So I want to, so you started Rescue. Let's talk a little bit about your relationship with the canine world. So you started rescuing dogs just kind of naturally, just organically, or what happened? How did you build? I mean, I want these people, these listeners, you guys, you have to understand what a large organization is that Wagtail is that Holly runs. It's a very large organization. It's been around almost probably close to 20 years now, 18 years, something like that.
It was started in 2003, officially 2004, we became 501c3. So,
and you've managed, I mean, I know from being with you last spring when we went to, you know, spending time with you for an extended period, that you're really a manager of a fairly large organization. And that, I mean, I remember you saying, you know, I want to be with the dogs, but, you know, I have to like organize everything. Like a lot of what you have to do now is you have a large, I don't know if you call it staff or whatever. You've got a lot of volunteers.
I have the most amazing group of volunteers, and like I could not ask for better volunteers. And it's really great because we're all very different, and we kind of like, you know, we fill in each other's pieces. Like for me, like sitting, like doing data entry, like I would rather stab myself repeatedly in the stomach. Where I have some people who find it relaxing. And, you know, so it's, you know, we've been able to find, it's like people, we all have the same passion. We have the same goal, and we've just been able to sort of combine our weaknesses and our strengths to make everything really, everything roll. And it's been great.
It's an amazing community. I mean, there have been periods where I've been pretty involved, and, I've met incredible people, and everybody is always so positive and helpful and, you know, a pleasure really to be around. And, I find that really, I think, I don't know what it is, but if it's, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with you, the way that you treat people and, you know, how great the dog species is. But I mean, I just want to tell you guys, one of the things that I really appreciated when I started working with, you know, rescuing or fostering, I should say, fostering dogs, was that your organization, Holly, was very, very supportive. And if I had to, a trip came up, a business, anything, and I really had to go, somebody would always come and take the dog.
Right.
And I didn't have to do a lot of work to find people to take the dogs, and the joy of getting a dog who is so afraid of humans from a kill shelter where Holly gets them. And then, having it in your home and seeing it blossom. And then the joy when somebody comes and gets it and takes it home. And then you hear about it, like they are so happy. I mean, you know, there was somebody I heard from for like 10 years after I helped them adopt a dog. I mean, it's really like a really positive experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we have 15 minutes left. Well, really just a little bit less because, you know, I have to push the show, push Radio Free Brooklyn and everything else.
Well,
but,
naturally.
What else is going on? Like, what's going on with the rescue now? What's going on? What have you been involved in lately?
Well, we definitely want to do some more Tijuana involvement. And, you know, it's like also I started doing CBD products for pets because I have a boy who was my unadoptable dog. And I have to say he was on Prozac, everything. CBD is the only thing that actually helped him. And I use CBD for fibromyalgia. So I started doing a lot of studying. I did some online classes. I did some market research. I was able to use the animals in my rescue to, you know, to try to see what different products. And, you know, I tried from different sources and I found a source that really works. And so I've been doing, it's called Cannabuddy Kitchen and Cannabuddy Butter, which is like this, It's peanut butter, but it's the consistency of cookie dough because I use isolate powders and I use glucosamine. And so you can sort of get the size of a ball you want of, you know, instead of like a goopy peanut butter, like, a, you know, running all over the place. Mm-hmm. So if your dog is really stressed out, you can like scoop out a big ball or you can get a little ball if it's just a little. So I've started doing that. And I guess the most reaffirming thing was my own veterinarian who was like, he looked into it and he's like, all right, I've looked and I don't believe any of this hocus pocus stuff works, but he's like, it doesn't hurt anything. He's like, they can, like, literally a dog could drink a whole bottle and mm-hmm. it wouldn't do anything. It's not toxic. He's like, it doesn't mm-hmm. interfere with any medicines I see. So he's like, you know what? If you believe in it, go for it. His bulldog had such bad arthritis and nothing was helping it. Mm. So one of his vet techs gave, who believed me with the CBD, gave some of my CBD. And I get this call on my phone. I'm like, Holly, can you bring me some more of that hocus pocus CBD stuff? And for the last 2 years of his bulldog's life until she finally passed away, he would like panic if he was running low on it.
Oh, wow.
So that was like, you know, because that was really to see somebody who was completely in disbelief that it worked and a veterinarian who had resources to everything. And so that made me really feel good. So I feel I love doing a product that helps. And so I'm also starting a new business and it's waggytime.com. I'm putting together my website. And what I want to specialize in is I don't have a certificate in training. I'm getting certified. I could probably train some trainers from all of the experience I had.
No doubt.
My specialty has always been the most fucked up animals and rehabilitating them. But what I want to really do is focus on, there's a lot of dogs that have come from the south to the city and they don't know how to navigate sidewalks. They don't know about apartments. Or if people are having a baby or a new partner, or there's some sort of a lifestyle change. And that can be really difficult on animals. And a lot of times people don't really know how to read the animals. They don't know how to communicate and they don't know how to work them through these periods. And that's a lot of the reason why people get very frustrated and end up in either just perpetual frustrating situations or end up giving the dogs up. And a lot of it can be fixed with just some like basic understanding. And, you know, it's like each individual animal is unique in personality. And so, you know, going in there and with my ability to sort of, you know, read each animal and tell the person how to communicate. So that's what I want to, and, you know, unfortunately, one of the things I've faced as a dog rescuer is I'm not paid to do this and people think that I should do everything with animals for free and free advice, but I need to eat. I have my own dogs to pay for. Mm-hmm. I have, and you know, my source of income after COVID has been really screwed. And so I don't feel any shame in making some money off of animals because it's my passion. I have dedicated years of free work to it and free experience. And I feel like it will asset both humans and me.
Well, you're kind of like a scientist about it. I mean, but self-trained, things that you can't learn in a book, like reading an animal.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like a mother and a child, like the mother knows what you can't teach that.
Yeah.
And it's a highly tuned instrument that you have and it, yeah. What, so people can hire you to do this.
Right.
And like, so how would it work? Like you can actually just kind of like watch the animal and the human and get a, is it like therapy? Is it like what I do? No, I mean, can you kind of like watch the animal and the person interact and then think like.
Right. And usually like I'll get like some notes like, you know, what's the daily routine? And also, you know, I can help them, you know, with canine enrichment, which is sort of a new career. I'm getting certified in that as well, which is basically how to make your dog the happiest it can be. You know, a lot of dogs are destructive because they're bored or they have different behavior problems. And a lot of it is just like miscommunication, misreading the animals. So I'm just starting my website. It's waggytime.com, and it's waggytime@gmail.com, waggytime@gmail.com. And so if anybody's interested in that, and I also, I teach pet first aid and CPR and do the CBD business. So I'm kind of incorporating the whole thing into sort of one, you know, comprehensive way to help people and animals, and hopefully, you know, expand it and get some help once I get going. But I think it's something that we really need. Did you know that 40% of American households have dogs in their families right now?
Wow.
It's incredible. It's an all-time high.
I kind of love that.
Right? That's according to actually a study I just read last night from the American Kennel Club.
I kind of love that.
Right?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Dogs, not guns.
Yeah. You know? Exactly.
You know, why don't, I mean, that's positive. We should be talking about that.
Yeah.
So do you go to like somebody's home and observe, or how does it work?
Yeah, I'll go to the home and I'll like, you know, spend some time with the person and the dog, and I'll just see how they're interacting, and then, you know, mm-hmm. just give some suggestions.
And you have like a whole bag of tricks. Like, you know everything. You know the veterinarian system. You know, like, the dog hospital system. You know the whole, like, nutrition, CBD stuff. Like, you have such deep experience that it isn't just like you've been trained in an area or worked at a vet.
Right.
So, and also you said dogs from the South are more, why, what is different about dogs from the South, say?
Well, a lot of dogs come, especially right now, it's like for two dogs to like mate and have puppies on the streets of New York and survive, it just doesn't happen. So most of the dogs that we're bringing in from like Texas, Alabama, Tijuana, they've never seen the streets of New York. And so they could be friendly with other dogs, but a lot of them have, you know, issues like it's called leash aggression, where they don't know how to behave when they're held to a leash and they see another dog, and it's frustrating for them. You know, they need to learn to navigate the skills of, you know, walking on a leash, the fears of like skateboards and things like that, and just really to gain confidence. And, you know, it's got to be really scary.
Like it would be for a human,
you know?
Or a child, or
yes.
anybody coming to visit this city. People won't come here by choice.
Yes. And a lot of people really misread the dog's signals. Mm-hmm. And so they're doing the best to their ability, and they are thinking that they're doing the best. And I mean, it's like, you can't hate them for it, but they aren't doing what's best for the dog because they aren't understanding the dog. Like, if a dog is wagging its tail, it doesn't mean it's necessarily happy.
Right.
Different things mean different things. It could mean that it's just really excited or overstimulated. So you have to be able to sort of tell the difference between, you know, the different body, the body signals, because dogs give body signals more than facial expressions. We give facial expressions to show the difference in our demeanors, whereas dogs, it's more, they give body language. It's their ears, their tails, the way they stand. And it's, you know, it's a different language, just like, you know, any other language to learn to read. And once you read it, it's just, it's so helpful.
Right. And it also sounds like not all of them, but there sounds like there's a lot of easy fixes in there, because once you can sort of explain the dog's behavior to the human, then it makes sense to them, right? And they're like, oh, I won't hold her that way or pet her that way, or I'll put the leash on at this point instead of in the home, or whatever you
right.
can tell.
And it's like, I have my own boy dog. I'm the first one to say he's the only dog I've not been able to fix because he was so messed up, but I manage him, you know, and he's a very happy dog, and he's, you know, he's managed, and I know how to treat, he's like a special needs child. Mm-hmm. But I just know what to do with him. And, you know, he's a little snuggle bunny, and my girl is his therapy dog. And so you know, some dogs, most dogs can be rehabilitated. Some of them are just never going to be 100%, but there's always a way to learn how to manage it so that you can still have happy lives together.
So if anybody's having any kind of frustration with their dog, I mean, I love that because it's so much bigger than like we, you know, we think of, you know, we think of like if we have problems with our pets, our dogs, we take them to a dog trainer or we take them to a specialist. But what you're talking about is just something intuitive that you can't really get at a veterinarian or anywhere else, really, if you ask me.
It's kind of an
interesting. And I have seen you with dogs. I mean, it's crazy. Holly is the dog whisperer. I mean, it's crazy. Like, I remember, guys, when, like, I went with Holly to Tijuana. We were in this, like, cement dog rescue, like a big yard, and run by two just local women, you know, pretty poor, I think. And the dogs were quite charming. I mean, I never felt, I don't know, I felt like I was in love with all of them. Like, there was a really good feeling there, and it felt like you were very much in control of the situation, and the whole place knew that, right? Is that what it felt like for you? Is that what it feels like for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, I was with also people who knew, but it's like, you know, just, you just have to know how to, you know, to interact. We saw, like, that one that, I don't know if you thought that one fluffy one that nobody could catch and just sat down and didn't look at her and just gave her her time and backed up to her and, you know.
And they know you get it. Yeah. And you're also involved with a network of other rescues right around the country. Yeah. And tell us about that a little bit.
So I work, like, Tijuana is my heart and soul. When I started that, that was my Mission Impossible. Started years ago. And what's wonderful is this place, like, I've seen, like, the foster homes are basically these just basically junkyards that these women, this woman, Berta, is like the main foster and she lives in it. And we've used some of the funds that we've raised to, like, rebuild to make her a safer place to live. Mm. And she has the biggest heart and she takes care of these dogs. And in exchange, she gets groceries and food and she, you know, she brings them to the vet and she prides them, you know, gives them care.
So you're really helping the community as well.
Right.
It's a it's a really positive thing. We're going to run out of time, so I want to make sure that you just give us all the information to contact you about any and all of this. Anything from, I mean, if you know, Holly's an open book. If you want to talk about being a dominatrix or going to a dominatrix, whatever you want, you could do that or find out about some getting some help for your dogs, or if you're thinking about rescuing or fostering a dog, any of that. Holly's an open book. So give us all your info.
So you can, for dominatrix info, you can email me as, I was Super Mistress Victoria was my name, and I still have supermistress@gmail.com. And I have NYC Bitch Academy that's still on Facebook that I may or may not reactivate. And for any kind of the dog training, that's my own girl. Angelina, come here. For my dog training services, it's waggytime, waggytime @gmail.com. And for rescue, you can just go to the website, Waggytail Rescue, waggytailrescue.org. And we've also got a big presence on Facebook and Instagram.
And stick around. Stick around. Keep it on radiofreebrooklyn.org. Don't forget to go to our website. Sign up for our newsletter. We're going to be having a lot of